Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I'm your host, Ken Mulman. This is the My View Matters Radio Network. And I apologize, the studio is running on delay here today for some reason, but we do have quite a bit to cover today. I don't know how much time we'll take. I've got time to go over the hour that we usually spend here, so we're going to try to get through as much as we can, but do it in a way that's sane so we can actually talk about these topics rather than rushing right through them. If you'd like to call in tonight, the number here is area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And if you call in, you can just listen to the show that way. But if you do want to talk, I need you to hit the one key after they prompt you to do that so I know that you want to talk. Getting things started for tonight, as usual, the political rhetoric generator has generated us some wonderful rhetoric tonight. Tonight's random bit of rhetoric is, my opponent is taking donations from Fox News cronies, high-paid lobbyists, and Muslim extremists. Always entertaining. So this week was Constitution Day was this past week, and there was a bit of news surrounding all of that, but one of the things that was going around on the internet and on Facebook and whatnot was a quiz to test your constitutional knowledge, and that was kind of fun to do, and they had a beginner, an advanced, and an expert, and I did all right. I got 9 out of 10 on the beginner. I think I got 42 out of 50 on each of the other two. What always gets me is when they play the word games of, well, what exact article and section was this phrase? I don't know. I know it's in there. I don't remember exactly where it's at. but whatever. That was kind of interesting. What was also interesting, there was some news about Constitution Day at UK, and you had there was a debate that happened later on in the day, but Senate candidates were invited to come speak. Mitch McConnell did not show up. He sent Jesse Benton, his campaign manager. Matt Bevin was there, and Libertarian David Patterson was there. Allison Grimes was also not there. So each of the folks, I guess, got to address the crowd first. And then later on in the day, there was a short debate, or I guess, between Jesse Benton on behalf of Mitch McConnell and Matt Bevin. And there were a bunch of people, you know, talking to me about this and trying to talk to me about, oh, look at this, look at that, look at this, look at that. And, you know, quite honestly, I just don't care. The Republican primary, first of all, I don't get the vote in it, even though I get to help pay for it, which honestly I have a big problem with. But, you know, more importantly, it's going to depend. That race is so interesting. It is interesting that you have Mitch McConnell, who is not well-liked nationwide, but I haven't seen any polls to suggest what his favorability is within the state of Kentucky. Obviously, unofficial polling, there's certainly a lot of people out there saying that Mitch McConnell's got to go. And that seems to be a chorus that seems to be being sung from a lot of different places, including from within the Republican Party. And so that's kind of interesting. At the same time, there's been some criticisms of Matt Bevin's campaign that he's too focused on what Mitch McConnell is saying about him this week, or making grand platitudes rather than specific policy statements. And in fact, I believe that's one of the things that I heard that came out of that debate was that Bevin was kind of pinned down on a couple of constitutional issues, because it is Constitution Day after all, or it was, and then was accused basically of not really addressing issues specifically. And that is something I've heard echoed around. But I honestly, I can't tell you exactly what appeals to Republican primary voters. It's not a race I've studied because I don't need to. But I think it is interesting to watch. But that all said, you know, I have no vested interest in that fight. And it is kind of interesting that people make a big deal out of it. And yeah, you know, chances are that whoever comes out of the Republican primary will be the next senator, you know, just based on how Kentucky tends to vote. But that doesn't mean it will be, and it doesn't mean I have to like it. So, you know, we'll keep watching that race as it develops. But, you know, quite honestly, again, I think there are bigger issues out there than Mitch McConnell or the Republican primary. And a lot of those are happening at home, things that we can be focused on, things that we can actually work to resolve. And I think that's where our efforts are best focused. Let's see here. Other things here, I guess I've just got some random news that's kind of interesting. There's a story from CNN earlier this week about a guy who had gut fermentation syndrome. And what that means is that he had an overgrowth of yeast in his gut that was basically converting all the carbohydrates into alcohol. He was consistently blowing a 0.40, which is rather significant, really. He was not drinking at all. And doctors didn't believe him. Everybody thought he was an alcoholic. Until they held him overnight one night for observation at the hospital, and they discovered that, hey, you know, there's been no visitors, there's been no one in or out of here, and it's been 24 hours, and his blood alcohol content is still 0.40. There's something funny going on here. And that's when they went through and discovered it. Now, apparently this is pretty common, or at least more common, in other countries. But it was kind of interesting, just a interesting thing. No, I'm not drunk. I've just got a yeast overgrowth. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting and something to bring to you. Let's see. Oh, here's an interesting one, a declassified document talking about how there was almost a catastrophe, a nuclear catastrophe, back in 1969 was when the document was written, that basically an aircraft broke up that was carrying two nuclear bombs. And essentially the crux of the article was that there was just one little switch that basically said, was this dropped or not, that determined whether or not the bomb was active. And just kind of an interesting thing, because you think about that, we were one switch away from accidentally nuking ourselves, which is kind of an interesting and scary thought if you think about it. You know, you could sit there and think about all the alternate timelines that were out there that could have occurred if we'd nuked ourselves in the late 60s. How different would the world be today? So one of the big national issues, and really a state issue as well, that's going around, probably the biggest one, is Obamacare. And, of course, the House Republicans did vote on the continuing resolution that specifically defunded Obamacare. And as this thing kind of rolls out, the numbers and the stats and the polls and just everything looks really bad for this law at this point. Maybe they're setting expectations low on purpose so that, hey, look, it's not as bad as you thought it was going to be. I don't know. Maybe. But it's not turning out well. There was a forum up here in Northern Kentucky this week, and put on by a group called Northern Kentucky Forum. And the Northern Kentucky Forum usually is a panel thing. Usually it's two or three people for something, two or three people against something, and a moderator. And this time, it was not that way. It was geared as an informational session only. And the moderator was the writer for the health blog at the Kentucky Inquirer. And the two speakers, one was from, I guess, Connect, which is the new exchange that Kentucky has set up. And the other was from something, and I wish I grabbed her card because I can't ever remember it, but I know it had social justice in it, and that's all I remember. And they went through for about 45 minutes to an hour, kind of going through explaining all the different things that are coming down the pipeline as far as what Obamacare means. And in the room, there were a lot of people that were older, very obviously were probably Medicare folks, just based on what it looked like. And then there were a few of us that were much younger. And the forum went on for a while. And, of course, I couldn't resist asking my question, which is the thing with Obamacare that creates me the most, is, you know, that I have a high-deductible health plan and that mine will be illegal under Obamacare come the beginning of next year. And if they could say if that was still the case and if they could elaborate, which I was pretty sure it was the case. But something they did explain and volunteered and something I had learned just this past week is that they've created this thing called catastrophic insurance for people who are under the age of 30. And in theory, it's going to work a lot like the high deductible health plans, although the cost of the plans are higher than the high deductible health plans. But in theory, it's going to do the same thing. It's going to put that $5,000 or $10,000 deductible on an individual where the first $5,000 or $10,000 comes out of pocket. And then after that, it's all paid for, which is exactly what I have in a high deductible health plan today. That's exactly how my plan works. The problem being, of course, that for me, the catastrophic plans are only available for people age 30 and younger, and I'm not under 30, I'm 36. So I still don't get to keep my health plan or anything like it, despite the fact that I like my health plan. And essentially, I had some questions, the audience had a lot of questions, something about 140 different plans are going to be offered through Kentucky, through the exchange. Most of them are going to be Anthem, Humana, and the Kentucky Health Cooperative, which was created with the startup money that we got from the federal government. It is that, and that's a subsidized plan. So the subsidized plan for the first 2 or 3 years is going to be significantly cheaper, in theory, than the private sector. And it's going to be interesting to see how that works out because the subsidized plans – could, in some instances, run insurance companies out of business, but those subsidized plans are going to run out of their subsidy in 3 years, and the cost will increase. My understanding is that most of the subsidies, so there's a couple of lines here. If you make up to 138% of the national poverty line, then you're basically covered with subsidies that make the healthcare almost free. And, of course, you know, we know that there's no such thing as free, but to the individual, it will appear to be free. From 138% of the poverty line up to 250% of the poverty line, there will be discounts available that they weren't real clear on whether those were permanent or temporary. I got the impression those were temporary. And those are basically more of that startup money, that stimulus to try to make this thing not so awful when it starts because, you know, they want people to adopt it and love it and live it and keep it and whatever. And it was kind of interesting because people at the forum, they're all, like I said, it was mostly an older crowd. Many of them had no interest whatsoever in the website that they're setting up for the exchange. Many people had questions about, do I get to keep my provider if I choose any plans? The answer is no, it still works like it used to, so you have to check which insurance providers are going to be taken by your healthcare provider. And so it's still not clean at all. It still actually makes things more confusing. And, in fact, the forum got so bad, they actually cut off questions 15 minutes early. And anyway, it was interesting to go and learn the side of things that is for this law. The funniest part, I guess, though, is that it's full steam ahead for the Democrats. They've got their heels dug in to protect Obamacare. And, you know, the funny part about it is that the majority of the American public does not want Obamacare at this point. I've got a few studies here. This one just came out this week. From the ABC, it's an ABC News Washington Post poll, just general views on Obamacare, 52% oppose the health care law, 52%. That's compared to 42% that support it And, of course, there's always that obligatory 6% that have no idea what's going on. The 55% of Americans disapprove of how Obama is implementing the law. And 62% believe that the law, they feel that they do not have adequate information on the law, that they are not sure what it's all about. And that's what that forum that I went to was supposed to be about, but I can tell you that many people walked away from there scratching their heads and just, I mean, it was a very interesting mood by the end of that forum. People were like, wow, this isn't really what I thought it was, and people were concerned, and I think that's why they cut the questions off early. Some of the other things that are interesting here, the effects of the new healthcare law, the poll here shows that, you know, the answers were better, worse, or no effect. And do they think that the healthcare law's effect on the overall healthcare system would be better, worse, or no effect? 39% no effect, 36% worse, only 19% say it would be better. For your family's health costs, 55% believe there's going to be no effect. 33% say it's going to be worse, and only 9% say it's going to be better. For you and your family's health insurance coverage, 61% think it'll have no effect on whether or not you have coverage, 25% believe it'll be worse, and 11% believe it'll be better. And then finally, the quality of health care you receive, 63% believe there'll be no change, 22% believe it'll be worse, and only 12% believe it will be better. So you're looking at an average of about 13 or so percent of people that are actually positive and think this healthcare law is going to be better than what we have now. And, it's very interesting. I think that people are starting to wake up. Another article from the AP kind of went into all the crazy details of what it's going to take to apply to get health insurance through the exchange, and that this is going to be a complex process for people. Now, in some ways, I kind of agree and kind of disagree. I mean, the one downside of employer-based insurance is you usually only get a choice of one or two, maybe three plans. So it is pretty straightforward. But that's not always to say that that plan is the best for you. As far as consumer choice goes, having the exchange and 140 different plans out there could be beneficial to a number of people. And if they set up the Connect, and by the way, that's KYNECT, that's the name of the exchange system, I guess, or website or whatever it is. If they set it up right and make it so you can filter it down and filter on criteria of it's this health, and I go to this primary provider and I want this kind of coverage, and if it walks you through like a wizard, it might be all right. But what I'm hearing is that that website isn't ready yet, and it's supposed to launch, 9 days? Good luck, guys. Good luck. The point is there's a lot of people kind of realizing that this is actually going to be more complex than our current setup, that it's probably not going to be cheaper, and that's actually the big thing coming out now, is it's not going to be cheaper. Your insurance premiums are not going to go down next year, and mine and 15 and a half million other people like me are definitely not going to go down because we're losing our high-deductible health plans. And, overall, the number of people who strongly disapprove versus the people who strongly approve, there's a 23-point margin in favor of strongly disapprove. And that's pretty significant, actually. That's, you know, think about that. A quarter of the population, that's even a funny way to say that. But they do these comparative things in these stats of who outnumbers who, those who are strongly opposed versus those who are strongly for, and then the comparison is whatever percent. So in this case, 23% more people strongly disapprove of Obamacare than strongly approve. That's not the right way to say that either. I hate when they do that kind of math, and I wish they'd just show me the numbers. But the point is, there's a significant number of people who strongly disapprove of this law, and not very many people who are really in favor of it. And it's in part due to news stories that keep coming out about places, large employers that are talking about cutbacks. And even the unions are now saying, hey, this isn't going to work out too good. And there's a whole bunch of people now that are very, very worried about how Obamacare is really going to affect them. And I can tell you, you know, we're what, 5 years into this recession now that started in 2008. And I would put forth that the big question marks revolving around this regulation specifically, and then all the other little things that have been passed along the way, are what have kept us in this recession. One of the main things that keep businesses from growing and keep business owners from continuing to grow their businesses is uncertainty. If they don't know what the business climate is going to be like, it's unwise to try to invest in something new when you don't know if you'll be able to protect what you've got. And so many, many business owners that I've talked to have gone into defensive mode. They are pulling back and holding off and waiting to see how this all rides out until the regulations kind of normalize and we get an idea of what this is going to mean, especially with Obamacare, which has all these things about the number of employees and the number of hours they work and all these different regulations involved. Until the employers see how this plays out, they're not really looking to hire. And a lot of places are looking to cut. The newest article that I saw this week is from the Cleveland Clinic. You know, they're basically cutting staff. And I believe it was $300 million worth of operating budget that they're trying to cut. Prior to that, there was, of course, the big story about UPS that dropped all the spouses off of their benefits, which is, you know, obviously not good for spouses and families and that kind of stuff. And that was done. They actually cited that Obamacare was the reason they did that. And, you know, it's just not looking good for them. And the news keeps getting worse and keeps getting worse and keeps getting worse. And so we continue to stay in this recession. And we're going to stay there until probably at least the middle of next year, assuming that the rules don't keep shifting, assuming that everybody understands what the law is by that point. That's where we're going to be. We're going to be stuck right there. And I hate what they've done with some of these things that are supposed to prevent loopholes, where if somebody owns multiple companies, then all of their employees add together in order to decide whether or not Obamacare, the mandate, applies to that business or not. And I know some of my more pragmatic friends and not libertarian friends will shake their heads when I say this, but, you know, if you've read Atlas Shrugged, one of the big things that happens in there is that the government decides that it's not fair that these big corporate conglomerates own multiple businesses, and they basically force them to bust these businesses into pieces. And they say that a person cannot own more than one company in more than one sector. And this thing about if you own more than one company and that all the employees add together, which does create the incentive to spin things off, sell things off, get rid of bits and pieces of your businesses, it really does sound familiar, or at least it kind of feels familiar. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, because quite honestly, I think it's not going to turn out well. We're at the bottom of the hour, and I'm going to take a break here. We're going to go. I forgot to set the counter up for 2 hours. So the longest we can go is 90 minutes today. But we'll probably take it because there's a lot more to cover. Folks, stay tuned. We'll be back here in just a few minutes. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. And hang on just a moment. We'll be right back.
So you're driving down the road, minding your own business, and bam, something hits your windshield and leaves a ding or even worse. Has this happened to you? Don't worry, folks. Help is here. Huntsman Auto Glass is family-owned and operated right here in Louisville. Huntsman Auto Glass only uses original equipment manufacturer replacement glass, and in most cases, any repair or replacement is paid for by your auto insurance. That's right. No deductible, no cost to you. Call Huntsman Auto Glass at 502-214-8566 or go to huntsmanautoglass.com for more info. Huntsman Auto Glass, where they will fix your smash in a flash. Tell them Ed sent you.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. And in the whole queue, and I'm bringing them on right now, Mayo, you are on the air.
Hey, how's it going tonight, Ken?
I'm doing all right, man. Hey, I apologize. This Blog Talk's acting bad tonight, so I apologize that I didn't see you in the queue.
No problem.
For me,
it's
so
a little finicky sometimes.
it is.
No, I mean, I just find it curious. You know, the things are being released. You talked about the you go to healthcare.gov, and no, the website still isn't up. They didn't get the funding to finish it. So when Obama or whoever it was stated, oh, yes, you know, you'll go on, you'll have the government option, there'll be how many of our other options you'll be able to choose from, answer a questionnaire based on, you know, family, dependents, income, et cetera, it's not there. So now the only plan is the government plan. Here recently in Louisville, you know, you brought up UPS, well, MSD, how Obama said, oh, if you want, you get to keep your doctor. If you got your insurance, you get to keep it. Well, they had to pay almost $20 per employee for them to keep it, which cost MSD over $100,000. And then the workers there,
yeah,
insurance went from one friend of mine, wife, two kids, you know, he'd been there for a while, like $178 a month to almost $400 a month. I believe Ed had a guest on his show talking about a Kentucky insurance something standards. You can look at the paperwork trying to find out. I don't know if that was Paul or somebody had called in trying to figure out what the increase would be, because Ohio has gone up 88%. And I believe they said Kentucky was looking like it was going to be a 70% increase in insurance costs. California.
Yeah, actually, I'll tell you what's funny about that costing is that David Adams, who's been on our show before a couple of times, has those numbers. But when the media calls, the media keeps getting the same line from the Connect people that, or the Department of Insurance folks, rather, that data is not available yet. But David walked in, he went to their office and basically demanded it and got that information. And then later on got a letter from their lawyer saying, hey, don't do that anymore. But the point is that they're telling people that they don't have that information yet, that they don't have the new rate information yet, but David actually has it.
It's out there if you know where to look or who to ask or what paperwork to demand.
Right, exactly.
But all these things that they're saying, oh, yes, you can do this, you can do this, you know, you'll be able to keep your doctor, your insurance will go up, et cetera. I mean, all the Medicare, Medicaid, different plans are going to be cut or changed already on, like, a lot of the prescription things. They've already started on the one. October 1st is the big date, which is come into some normal stuff and a few conspiracy theory things. Try to stick with the normal stuff, but nobody is admitting, even the CBO, their newest numbers even, it has gone up another, originally Obama said, what, $961 billion, and then that went to 1.137, then 1.3 something, and the second to last was it was $691 billion more than Obama had said, and the latest CBO basically states, Obamacare is unsustainable.
Right.
So how can they keep wanting to tout this program? And, you know, the Democrats that were doing it, I don't know if they're still holding out, but we're trying to hold the veto on funding the government for defunding Obamacare. To me, I have to agree with. How can you have a program that's going to force the American government to increase its debt ceiling when the debt ceiling is only supposed to be increased in times of war or national emergency because a president wants, you know, his little pet project to go through?
Right. No, I'll tell you, it's amazing. And you know, those CBO numbers, the way that all is calculated, can be gamed. And that's part of the problem that we have with some of the early numbers, was that they only look from now until a certain time. And they have to base it off of what's happening right now, and they have to base it off of certain other factors. So there's ways to game that formula. And so, you know, the original one, when they came out and said, oh, yeah, it's going to save us money in the long run, I laughed. I mean, the number of programs that they've said, oh, yeah, this is going to save us money in the long run, that have never, ever saved us a nickel and end up actually bleeding us out over time, is a much longer list than the ones. I don't know of any program that's actually saved us money at the federal level. I would invite someone to bring one forward, because I don't know of a single cost reduction plan that's actually worked at the federal government level. It seems that all they're good at doing is spending money, taking it from others and spending it on stuff. So I don't know, man. And I'll tell you, and this I'm going to get into here in just a minute, is, you know, MSD with the insurance increase, right? Well, where's that money going to come from? That's coming out of your pocket, because MSD gets their money from you, right?
Correct.
And
well,
not only that, though,
so
you've got...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. Nope, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I just started to say that's why you have so many. I mean, look at how many have that supposedly, I mean, you know, Pelosi's famous statement, you have to, you know, sign it so you can find out what's in it. Well, number one, I thought that was against the laws of the House or the Congress, you know, on any kind of vote, you know, whatever information. Obama even said, oh, before anything comes up, it'll be put out on the web and people can read it, you know, a month before Congress or the House even votes on it. Well, the Congress and the House didn't even get a chance to vote on it because the way they tricked that deal and everything and got it to 5 days. Well, there's no way anybody can read an over 1,800-page document in 5 days, you know.
And it wasn't even 5 days.
So,
I mean, by the time they got to that final version, that final version was out for 24 hours or less. I can't remember because they had the one and then it died and they went to the Senate and the Senate dropped theirs in real fast. And that's the one we ended up with, is it started in the Senate and then went to the House, which whether or not they have the ability to do Obamacare has now been decided by the courts that it is a tax. And therefore,
well,
it's
about taxation.
But my understanding is,
then?
Well, here's the bigger question: aren't all taxes supposed to start in the House? And that's the thing.
That
if it
of,
is
yes.
a tax, then it should not have started in the Senate. And that bill started in the Senate, and that has not been challenged yet. In light of, the, as far as I know, in light of the Supreme Court ruling that it's constitutional on the grounds that it's a tax, somebody needs to go back and attack it and say, well, if it's an attack, if it is a tax, then it should have started in the House. Because now it's a spending bill, and that has to start in the House. And
well, correct. I mean,
that would
so
be
many
the way
little
to attack that.
That are almost like, I want to say, double jeopardy. They're supposed to be in there, but they're not. It's like if Jefferson County or, you know, LMPD came to you with a warrant, and if something is misworded on that warrant, it is thrown out. Okay, your attorney can look at it and say your paperwork wasn't even right. We're not even coming to court, and it's gone and over with. Just like what you had said, there are so many different things, you know, on or in Obamacare. I mean, what gets me a lot of people, I'm sorry, Judge, oh, dagnabbit, Scalia?
Roberts was the decider.
Roberts
was
sorry.
The one that made the decision. Yeah, Chief Justice Roberts.
But he, you know, he asked, and they changed it. When they changed it, I mean, with what he said, if you actually go through, read, and listen while that was going on, not what the press was giving out because they were all confused at the time, not what, you know, but if you read it, he basically says, okay, American public, legally they can do this, but here is your out. You know, you have to call this a tax. And they went through the thing, the broccoli argument and everything, call it a tax, call it, and they finally did admitted that it was a tax. Well, if it is, like you says, it has to go back to the House, but and I'm not an attorney, then why hasn't it? You know, like you just said. If the document was misworded when it was gone through and approved for vote, why has it not been, you know, banished, taken out of law, and been rewritten, you know, different things in it that they said weren't in it, you know, Sarah Palin, you know, to bring her up, but, I mean, she called them death panels. Well, not death panels. They're called quality of life panels. Okay.
That's right.
That's
so much more flowery. That's so much nicer than the image of the skeleton with the sickle.
Yeah. And then the one, I mean, I'm not an attorney, but like the first section, 1A, 4C, something about keeping your doctor, right there it tells you, if you whatever, nope, you don't get to keep it. So.
Right. Well, Mayo, I've got a bunch more to cover. You got anything else?
If I do, I'll chime in, but I thought it was funny because, like I said, at work we had gotten something from, you know, because of Obamacare, you know, October, you know, 2013, but basically Department of Labor has issued a deal and a statement and about the savings through the marketplace, which I'm like, how? Because the marketplace isn't up yet. But they made us sign a piece of paper when they gave us this piece of paper, you know, saying that you have gotten this information. And yet, when you, like I said, you go to healthcare.gov, there's nothing there. I went through, I filled it out one time just to try, and it just says, please refer to your employer or your local healthcare insurer or workplace resources or something. nothing on the site. You know, it was a joke.
No.
So.
And then, I'll tell you, in Kentucky, we're going to have our own now. So you won't go to healthcare.gov. You'll go to kynect.ky.gov or something like that. Ours isn't up yet either.
Yeah, at last view, I'd sent it to Ed, Kentucky was still undecided. I mean, I think there's only like 7 or 8 red states which are not at all doing Obamacare, which are like the Midwest, Texas, and the states surrounding it. But Kentucky had gone from like dark blue, definitely doing Obamacare, as of September 17th, Kentucky had switched to undecided.
Well, the only reason it's undecided actually is because of David Adams. So essentially the deal is the exchange was created here in the state through executive order. There was no legislation that enabled Beshear to set this thing up. He just did it. And David Adams is now suing, saying you can't just do that. You can't just create stuff. Yes, you're the governor, but there has to be enabling legislation. And so that lawsuit is now, I guess, at the Supreme Court. I can't keep track of all David's lawsuits, so I don't know what's where. But I know that one's going through the courts. And, you know, quite honestly, I hope that he wins. I mean, even if I was in favor of Obamacare, I would hope that he would win on the fact that we don't need government that's unaccountable to the public. We need to make sure that the process is followed. A bill is supposed to start in the House and go to the Senate. It can go the other way for some bills, but not for others. But whatever, it gets through the legislature and then it gets over to the governor, and then the governor signs or vetoes, and there's overrides and, you know, whatever. But there's a process for a reason, and I would really hope that even if you support Obamacare, you would reject the idea of creating this under an executive order, because the next time you have a governor in office that you don't like, that governor, if this case is upheld, if he decides to start building stuff that you don't like, you're not going to have the ability to go after that either. And so this is important. It's important to note that even if you support Obamacare, you should not support it being created in Kentucky by executive order. It should be the legislature's job to create all of this, fund all of this, and then give it to Beshear to run it, which is the way it's supposed to be. We're off track. Mayo, thank you for calling. I see you've dropped off. I guess you had to go back into work. I know you're working tonight, but thank you for checking in. We have... We mentioned about MSD having to pick up higher insurance costs. And along with that, these first few years of subsidies that are helping keep the exchange plans lower than regular insurance plans, essentially they're just subsidies. Well, they come from the federal government as well, and they're coming. How does the federal government get money? It gets it from you and me. It's taxes, right? Tax money. On top of all of that, on top of the prolonged recession that we have, that the local taxing entities and local governments really didn't even start feeling until 2011 when the stimulus money ran out, you now have a slew of taxing entities that are hurting for cash, and they're trying to scramble to figure out what to do, so they keep raising prices and raising taxes and raising everything else. And an interesting story that came out this week: the consumption of water in Louisville has plummeted. And as such, there's a new budget problem at the Louisville Water Company, because they aren't getting the income, because you're not buying the water there in Louisville. Somewhere there's a joke about don't drink the water. But you're not buying the water in Louisville, so they're not making their numbers. And by not making their numbers, they're looking at, instead of saying, oh, good, conservation, hooray, they're saying, oh, my gosh, we're not going to be able to keep our bureaucracy afloat. And so they're looking at raising your water rates. It's the same thing that's happening with the libraries, right? The libraries are jacking up the rates to protect their fiefdoms. And all these different government entities are having to raise their taxes and raise their rates and raise their taxes and raise their rates. And what is inevitably going to happen is that the taxpayers, and it's already starting to happen, the taxpayers are saying, enough, enough. We can't afford anymore. We can't keep doing this. And so somewhere, someone is going to lose. And unfortunately, where we're going to lose is at the local level, where we're most accountable. The accountability is the Achilles heel of the taxation, because when we have the feds taxing us to death and the states taxing us to death, we can't do a whole lot about it. You and I, we're one voice among 300 million people at the federal level. You and I are one voice among 4.35 or so million people in the state. But in your county, depending on which county you're in, Jefferson County aside, even in Jefferson County, you're only one in a million. But you go into a county like mine where I'm one in 15,000, and you're going to have people up in arms saying that we can't afford all these taxes. Well, what taxes are what entities are the ones that are going to take the hit? The ones that are going to take the hit are the local guys. Your local services are what are going to take the hit, because people can't afford to keep paying these taxes. And it's hilarious to watch these bureaucrats and these people in local government promote these big government plans and protect them and say, oh, yeah, well, that federal program's great. Oh, yeah, that state program's great. Don't you realize it's your own job that you're calling for the end of? It's your job. Because at the end of the day, the person that's easiest to get rid of out of the bureaucracy is you. It's really hard to knock the bureaucracy out of Washington, D.C. or out of Frankfurt. It's really easy to knock the bureaucracy out of a taxing district in a county of 10,000, 15,000, even 100,000 or 200,000. It's a lot easier to do than knocking it out of the state. That's what's going to happen next. We're going to have a conflict between taxing entities. And it's going to be interesting, because people are really starting to see here that we're spending a lot of money in taxes and we've got a lot of liabilities. We see the debt continue to climb, and people realize that can't keep going. That's got to stop eventually. I mean, it doesn't have to, I guess. There's some projection that in the next, what was it? Oh, shoot. I want to say it was 20 years. Maybe it was 25. We're going to be at 200%+ of GDP. Our debt will be at 200%+. And by the way, that's where Japan went when they finally blew up and had their lost decade, where they just suffered terrible, terrible, terrible recession for a decade. And ironically, we're spending ourselves into that scenario trying to resolve a recession that's mainly caused because of all the new regulations. Oh, government creates more problems, so government tries to solve them by creating more problems, and then government, it's insane. If you just go after the root problem, we'd actually solve the darn problems. But anyway, one of the interesting parts that's come out of all this, because of the different taxing entities, is tolls. And in Louisville, they're already talking about setting up the tolls on the bridge over to Indiana, where bridge is. And here in Northern Kentucky, of course, there's a big fight over the use of a public-private partnership, so that the public-private partnership can be the one who does the tolling. And basically, the government will take a one-time lump sum payment of whatever for a lease, and who knows how many years the lease will be for, that basically gives them the ability to own that piece of infrastructure in a monopolistic fashion for the next whatever number of years. And there's nothing that controls how high they can put the tolls on that road in that scenario. I am a private sector guy. I believe in the free market. I do see that at times there is a case to be made that local governments, small and accountable, can do core services and do them better than the private market could, because anybody else doing it would be a monopoly, right? There are these things called natural monopolies, things that are obviously become monopolies. You can't have 27 sewer lines running down the same stretch of road, right? I mean, that's impossible. So the sewer is a monopoly. Those type of things, I can see a role for government. Public-private partnerships, in my opinion, based on what I've read and seen, and I can give you examples and I will in a moment, public-private partnerships are bad because they are a combination of the worst of capitalism and socialism. What it is, it's corporatism, where government gives a monopoly to a company. That company then can do whatever they want with that core monopoly infrastructure. And in return, that company then will obviously kick back money to certain politicians that supported them and helped them get that awesome bit of revenue that they're going to get. Now, this is different than what we have here in Kentucky today. We have the co-ops, right? The co-ops, the idea there is that it's not really for profit. That's the idea of a co-op, right? Yeah, it's private, but it's not. It's almost a not-for-profit company that works just to be for the benefit of the people that it serves. That's okay, I guess. It's kind of weird, but it works-ish. My big problem, though, is in a PPP, public-private partnership, they are giving monopoly infrastructure away. And in Chicago, this is the example I was going to tell you, the city of Chicago sold all of its parking rights to a company about 3 or 4 years ago. And in the first 3 years, parking rates have between doubled and quadrupled, depending on where you are in the city, making it that some parts of the city are now over $20 an hour, $20 an hour to park. That's $160 a day to park your car. Insane. And there's nothing the city can do about it because they signed a 99-year lease because that was a good idea. You know, sign it out for the next five generations. And that's the crazy thing. You're literally signing away a critical piece of your infrastructure for five generations. Wow. Think about that. That's a long time. So one of the things, and getting back on track with the roads, one of the ideas that's been floated out there is if you're going to, and I've said this, you know, if you're going to toll, then everything should be tolls. If you're going to do gas tax, then everything should be gas tax. But you shouldn't have both, because tolls and gas taxes, it's really double taxation. And one, the gas tax is already kind of hidden anyway, right? Because you don't, most people don't sit there at the pump and go, okay, well, I just paid $1.50 or $1.50. I just paid $3.50 a gallon. And of that, you know, this was a sales tax for the state. This was for the, nobody pays attention to that. So it's already hidden. But the putting tolls on top of it is just another tax. And so the guys over at Reason Magazine, or the Reason Foundation, put together here a idea that basically they would toll by the mile all interstates. And the toll by the mile would raise $1 trillion annually for actually maintaining the highways, which I then ask the question, what about the gas tax? How much is that raising, and does that really solve the problem? But they are basically looking at, 3 cents per mile for cars and 14 cents a mile for big rigs. Now, of course, all this stuff ends up getting bundled into the cost of everything anyway, right? And that's one of the fallacies of all of this, is that if you just tax the trucks, well, that's a business expense. It'll just get tacked onto the cost of every good that they're hauling. But I guess the point is that there's going to be a lot of talk about alternate revenue sources. There's going to be a lot of talk about reprioritization. There's going to be a lot of talk about taxes, because we have so many liabilities and so many big things coming down the pipeline from the feds that we have to. The local governments, people are not going to be able to afford to pay these taxes to the locals when they have to pay so much to the feds. And at the local level, they're not going to stand for it, because, again, that's where they have control. They have to. All the while, here in the state, I mean, Our finances here in the state are terrible. We've got big problems here in Kentucky, too, which, again, how does that get solved? Through more taxes. it's just not going to turn out well. We're going to end up paying a lot of money in taxes, and these local guys are the ones that are going to beat up on it. Looks like Mayo wants to jump back in here. I'm going to bring him on. Mayo, you still there?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm here. You may know more. I mean, I'm a little older, but you inner workings know a little more. I thought years ago when they first start building 265, and between Kentucky and Indiana, that's why Indiana agreed to have 265 designed the way they did. We agreed to have 265 designed the way we did. And either Kentucky paid for the highways and the government was going to pay for the bridges, or Kentucky said, oh, okay, we'll pay for the bridges, and the government gave us the money for 265 for Indiana and Kentucky. And that's why the bridge was supposed to go out Prospect, and the other one was supposed to go, you know, out by Riverport. So what happened to that money that, you know, what happened to that?
Well, I can tell you a whole bunch of our money in the state of Kentucky goes out to the parkways. You know, I'm a big road geek in general, and there's nothing that drives me crazier than badly designed highways. The Bluegrass Parkway runs from Bowling Green to the middle of freaking nowhere. That drives me absolutely insane. You have 100-and-something miles of highway that go to nowhere. They're 20 miles away from I-75. Freaking finish the highway. Make it at least usable. You've got the Western Kentucky Parkway, which thankfully now is part of the interstate system, or will be. I know they've shielded it as I-69 now, at least parts of it. But, I mean, I've driven that. It's a four-lane highway. It's really nice. Mayo, I'm sure you've driven I-71 between Louisville and Cincinnati. Mm. Same style of highway, but the road's in a lot better condition because no one uses it. And, I mean, it's just 200 miles out to Paducah. Now, I understand that we have, or not 200, it's 120-something miles out to Paducah from Louisville. But, and I understand that we have to have connectivity throughout the state, right? We have to have a way to transport across the state. But I'll tell you, man, the Western Kentucky Parkway is a really nice, way overbuilt highway for what is necessary. And we've been paying for that for what, a decade, two decades, three decades? I mean, how long have we been paying that extra money? When, you know, and I don't mean to sound like I want to forgo anybody else in the state from getting what's rightfully theirs, right? But everyone knows the economic driver in this state is Northern Kentucky, Louisville, and Lexington. That's the triangle. And everybody calls it the Golden Triangle because of that. And so you should be building your infrastructure for the long term, and you should be looking at investing in those places so that, yeah, okay, in theory, you can later on go build a highway to nowhere. I mean, you know, whatever. Not really. I would never support a highway to never, but nowhere. But the point is that we do things backwards, and our state's in a deep, 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 deep hole. We're in deep trouble. I mean, our pensions.
we're getting close to Detroit so level. I can't remember who it was, just did a study, but Kentucky was cited as being like the third city to maybe, or third state to possibly, declare bankruptcy. That's how close we are, but they keep it away from us because of these idiots that they let double and triple dip in the pension is why. I mean, I have no problem somebody works somewhere and earns their pension, but not if they're going to, oh, I'm going to work part-time on this board, then I'm going to run for this office, then I'm going to be part-time on this, but yet they're going to get three full pensions? No. To bring as an example of, you know, the tax dollars at work and that 200%, a friend of mine, he used to say, oh, this is screwed up, but at least they keep the grass cut, okay, in Louisville. And used to, they did for years. The expressways, Butchel, everything like that, all right? They've cut the grass only twice this year in Butchel. The grass was 7.5, 8 feet tall in the median across from Basher Manor Lane because they don't have the tax money to pay the guys to go out there to cut it. So it's service is going to go, okay?
Yep.
Then what happens when it does finally hit or gets to the point and says, oh, we can only run a 9-to-5 fire department, or the police department will only be run between the hours of, you know, 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. Monday through Thursday. Or instead of having, oh, we need 1,000 officers, working three shifts, we're only going to be able to support 450 officers working on-off 12-hour shifts. You know, maybe they start doing police officers like they do firemen, one day on, 24 hours, one day off or something. Okay, now I just gave some politician a bad idea.
Well, no, I'll tell you, it is going to happen because, again, the feds and the state are taking so much out. People only have so much to give. You know, there comes a point where I can't afford anymore. I mean, I literally cannot afford to give you anymore. And for many people, that point has already been reached, and in many communities. And it's and the funny thing is, it's not just one thing. It's these nickel and dime, literally nickel and dime increases on taxes, right? Mm-hmm. When they increase things 5% year over year, 4% year over year, you know, 4% increase over the course of a decade is 48% increase. Man, I don't know about you, man, but I'm not making 48% more than I made 10 years ago.
No.
You know,
the cost of living has kept going up and up and up, and they have not kept, minimum wage standards like they were supposed to have. Who was it that the government building's named after him? But he was set on three different committees, like the Means and Way Committee, the Immigration, and the Minimum Wage. And he told them at that time, this is a three-legged stool. If you do not keep up with all three, it will fall. Well, they didn't keep up with minimum wage, so that and immigration, and that let the immigration continue coming in, and that since the immigration was allowed to come in, then hey, guess what? They didn't need to raise the minimum wage because they could afford cheap labor by having the, you know, the green card workers and et cetera like that. And it, you know, some people will go, oh, well, you're racist or you're this or whatever, and I'm like, you know, my poppy's Puerto Rico. I've had a guy from Africa living with me. You know, the only thing I'm racist against is stupidity, and that's what we've had happen. People have been stupid, have not stood up and taken it, you know, and done what they should have because they've forgotten that they have the power, which kills me is why, I mean, the power of the states against the federal government, you know, that they forget that they, it seems like,
but
they
the problem
you know,
is,
forget that they have.
Mayo, every dollar we send to the federal government, they send us $1.50. It is really hard to bite the hand that feeds you. That's our problem.
Well,
and,
why?
And, you know, we
why
will never, we cannot stand
anything?
Up.
You know, the federal government
because
is there,
we spend
for
too
the
much.
Army, the Navy, you know.
I agree, but we spend too much money.
You know, all the fun stuff.
We spend too much money. We spend more than we actually generate for ourselves and what more than what's generated in the state. We spend it. That's how we We send a dollar to Washington, D.C. They send us $1.50 back, and somehow we still end up in the hole every year. Now, think about that. We're getting 50% more than we send to D.C., and we still run out of money. And I've got a story here, and then I've got to get to a break because we're way, way over.
All right. You can throw me back in the queue then, and that way you can get your story out. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Real quick, the one thing that I see here, talking about the taxing entities fighting each other, it's already starting to happen at the state. I found a case here from 2008 where Beshear took money out of Beshear took money out of the charitable gaming, the agency that oversees charitable gaming, took money out of there to pay for debt that the state owed. Which I'm sure, because of how the lawsuit formed up, probably led to the gambling folks probably said, oh, well, we can't approve all these permits. We've got a backlog. We had to lay people off because we don't have any money. You end up in these fights with taxing entities fighting each other, and that's what we're going to see more of. And the downside is the one that's going to lose, the side that's going to lose, are the ones that are the most accountable, the ones that are closest to us, the ones that we have the most control over, because we have to. We have to give somewhere. Something has to give, and we have no control over what the feds do. We have no control, no reasonable control over what the state does or the feds do. We have reasonable control over our local communities. And as a result, they're the ones that are going to lose. They're the ones that are going to see the cutbacks. The stuff that Mayo was talking about where fire departments are only on 8 to 5, or police maybe 4 days a week, 8 to 8, or maybe it's 5 days a week, 8 to 8, and some minimal shift at night. It's going to be bad. Folks, we're way, 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 way over for a break. Stay tuned. We've got about 20 minutes left when we get back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springson of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network, and we've got about 20 minutes left of the hour and a half tonight. So usually we're here for an hour, and we do enjoy having you guys listen live. We do enjoy having you guys call in. In the chat room, I apologize. I have not been over there enough tonight, but it looks like somebody bumped me off anyway. So anyhow, I guess the point is that we've got a real problem here with spending, a real problem, and we just keep compounding it and making it worse. There are places where we could start immediately stopping the bleeding, things that could be done that would make things so much better immediately. There was a new statistic that came out that all marijuana arrests, the number of marijuana arrests across the country, outnumbered all actual violent crime. And, you know, it's we're putting people in prison for marijuana possession. And at the end of the day, if they're not hurting anybody, who cares? We should be focused on real crimes against real people and not against crimes of people doing things that, well, society doesn't approve of. Well, you know, I don't like the idea of society deciding what's legal or not based on approval. I think that we need to be focused on things that actually hurt people, things that actually do harm to people. That's where the focus should be. And it's entertaining to see when Obama came out and said, hey, we're not going to go after Colorado and Washington State for legalizing pot. The bureaucracies, the federal law enforcement bureaucracies, screamed bloody murder. Oh, my gosh. The reality is a lot of the money that comes into the police agencies is drug interdiction money. And, of course, it gets used for general things like just hiring police and whatever. But there's a cost involved in all this beyond just the police. You've got the court costs and the time in the court and attorneys and prosecutors, and you've got incarceration costs. And if you go the nicer route that we have now, which forces people into diversion programs rather than to jail, which is better than sending them to jail, that still costs money. And there are smarter policies, better policies out there that can be done for cheaper with better results, and we've seen that out of Portugal. We've seen those great results there. That's a great place where one can start right away, and you can cut prison incarceration probably 50%, which would save a ton of money. But then you'd have local communities, and we've already seen some of this here in Kentucky, scream bloody murder. Oh, my gosh, we built these jails, and now there's no one to put in them. That's a problem? Really? Personally, I think that's a good thing. We shouldn't be looking to lock people away. It shouldn't be a system built around, well, we need to reach a quota of people we need to lock up. That's a horrible, horrible way to go about things. And, of course, those prisons, they use tax money to build those to begin with, or bonds or whatever. And so that's why the local communities are now screaming, because they've bonded out a jail for 25, 30 years, and now they don't have the money coming in from the state and the feds to pay for it. And we keep compounding problems. And all these problems are layers and layers deep, and all we seem to do is make them worse. We seem to continue to pile more problems on, rather than actually solving the core problem. We put another Band-Aid on it, another Band-Aid on it, another Band-Aid on it. There are better ways to be spending the money. There are better ways to be saving money. And I think that the public in general is getting it. We're finally starting to see things come along now to the point where the public is really starting to get it. And it's been a laundry list of things that have caused that. You've got, we had the internet censorship stuff, and we've had the NSA spying and the drones and all these different things that the American public in general is against. And now we see Obamacare being ramrodded through. You know, the Republicans are going to try to defund it. It's probably not going to work, but whatever. You know, the public is getting to the point where they're getting very, very frustrated. And what we're seeing, and what I've been seeing, is a swing in general of the public towards a more liberty position. They're finally starting to say, we have too much government. And there was a poll that came out recently that shows that I think it's 52% of Americans in general believe that there is too much government. 52% say too much. That doesn't count the people who think it's just about right. Obviously, it's not just 52 too much and whatever percentage not enough. And there's probably that 6% in the middle that still doesn't know. I still want to meet some of this 6% that really has no opinion on anything. But the point is that, you know, there's 52% of the public now believes that government's too big, that it does too much. Now, there's obviously division over what to cut, and that's the big thing now, right, is what should get cut first. But we're finally reaching that point where people are saying there's too much government. And this also has the local taxing entities nervous. You know, that's another pressure on them because, again, where is it most accountable? Where are we most able to affect change? At the local level. But, again, there are certain things at the local level that can and probably, arguably, should be done by local government because it's local and accountable, and it provides for the local community. Things, again, like sewers, where, you know, you can't really do that privately unless you have a septic tank, and septic tanks work okay as long as you're in an area that has enough population distribution to be able to support that, or, you know, perks and all that good jazz. But the point is that we're seeing a swing in general of the public towards liberty, and that's a good thing. I think that certainly for far too long, we've entrusted government with far too much power. That's one of the big things. It's funny. The government will say, well, wait a second. You know, we saw this a lot with the Tea Party folks. The Tea Party rose up and started looking backwards at what it had been occurring for the last 5 or 10 years. And they're like, well, this is crazy. What are you doing? And literally the government's response is, well, nobody complained about it when we did it. That's because the public was asleep. And now that the public is awake, they have a big problem with not only what's trying to be pushed through now, but what's already been pushed through. And so there's this pushback. And it's interesting because, and I know that this is happening. I mean, I've seen it. I've experienced it. I've been doing outreach stuff with the Libertarian Party, which I also do. Those of you that listen often know. We've seen a lot of very positive response to us this year. And even people that are still staying Republicans and Democrats are, you know, kind of like, yeah, you know, we agree with you on a lot of stuff, you know. Wow, you know, and they're all kind of stymied and stammering around. And, you know, and that's okay. I'll work with anybody who wants to work with me on an issue. But it's interesting to see this swing. And one of the things that's coming because of this swing are news articles, hit pieces on libertarianism. The funniest one I saw here recently was on Bloomberg, and that's so ironic that it's on Bloomberg, hitting libertarians claiming that we're the new communism, which I think is absolutely hilariously ironic coming from the news organization named after the guy who is trying to create a total nanny state in the city of New York. Where, you know, you can't smoke, you can't drink, you can't have too much soda, you can't have too much salt, you can't have this, can't have that, can't have too much this, can't have that. it's ironic, if nothing else, to see that the Bloomberg news outlet is harassing libertarians claiming that we're communists. And you know, the only part of this whole story that has any merit whatsoever is that there is, in radical libertarianism, an overreaction at times to things, and also a lack of realism in or pragmatism inside of radical libertarianism. And radical anything has that. I mean, that's just the point of being radical, right? I mean, if you're got a radical philosophy, it's radical because it doesn't usually anyway. It's because they don't take into account the ramifications of your policies. And so the not-so-radical libertarians realize you can't change the world overnight. And in fact, for people like me, I think that a lot of what I do is specifically to try to prevent really bad things from happening all of a sudden, because that's where we're heading. We're heading towards that wall. We're heading towards that cliff. And we keep speeding up. And it's people like myself that say, whoa, hey, slow down, slow down, slow down. We got to stop. We're about to go over the cliff. We can't just keep doing this. We can't just keep going the way we're going, because it's all going to crash and it will radically change overnight, and it will be bad. And there are some within the radical libertarian community, the one branch, that say, good, hooray, let the system crash. They have absolutely, in my opinion, no offense if you're one of those folks, but I'll argue with you all day and night that that is not a rational approach to things. And to think that somehow you're going to end up with liberty coming out the other side of that, history shows us that that will not be the case. And so the point is that we have opportunities here. We have an opportunity to really start having an adult conversation about the size and the scope of government, and specifically how much we want them in our lives. And do we want to trade all of our liberty for safety? Do we want to trade all of our liberty for the government telling us how to live a perfect life so we can live an extra year or two? Do you really want that? That's the conversation that we need to be having right now. How much liberty do you want? How much safety do you want? There is a balance. And I believe for far too long, the government has been focused on safety, because government cannot give liberty. Government can only take liberty. Government gets its power from taking from you and I. That's where they derive their power. They have no power anywhere else, any way else. Otherwise, it'd just be a bunch of dudes saying, hey, we want to do this. And if they had no power to do it, be like, great, let me know how it works out. I'm not taking my money. I'm not interested in that project. So, you know, whatever. It's only because they have the power that they're able to then implement these programs. And so it's time to have a very serious adult conversation about, you know, there's going to be a short term and a long term to this. On the short term side, there's got to be a conversation about what can we do today? What is it that we can immediately cut today? Because there are going to have to be cuts today, and immediate cuts. There have to be. Just the rate at which we're growing is far too fast. Just to get us to quit growing out of control, there's going to have to be cuts. Then once we make the tough cuts up front, we start talking about, okay, and now that we've made those cuts, what's our goal 5 years out, 10 years out? Where do we want to be 5 or 10 years from now? Do we want to be a nation that's at 200% in debt compared to its GDP, where there's drones flying around, and you know, Michael Bloomberg sees on a drone that you've bought a soda that's too big and you get a fine? Do we want to be a society where cameras track our every move? Do we want to be a society where the NSA knows everything about us? Or do we want to be a society that's about liberty and individuals allowed to make individual choices, so long as you don't force those individual choices on others? Do we want to be a society of private property and free association? Do we want to be a community based on voluntarily being a community rather than being forced into a broader community with people that we don't agree with. Those are the adult conversations we're going to have. And now's the time to have them. Right now. Because right now, the country is sick of what's going on. We're 5 years into a recession. Republicans, Democrats, they have no clue how to solve this problem. Their only answer is more government. And the problem is more government only digs us deeper. It only gets us in even deeper, worse than we were before. That's the adult conversation we're going to have. Mayo, I'm bringing you back on here, brother. Are you here?
Yeah, I'm here. I just I don't know what flavor libertarianism is. I kind of have a few leanings. I haven't looked into a lot of it, but I think they were some of the first ones that, you know, stood up as, you know, the American citizen should. I mean, you were just talking about the, you know, NSA and the PRISM and et cetera, and, you know, it gets me if, you know, if someone's suspected of being involved in something illegal, investigate that person. You know, let the government or the law enforcement get search and wiretaps, you know, for that person.
Yes.
You know, but when the government isn't accountable, you know, to the same laws of the citizens that it governs, then what you have is tyranny. Okay?
Yeah.
And, you know, for what you and other libertarians that, you know, that are speaking up on things that I do like, you know, it's the fact that, you know, it isn't about being honest and law-abiding. You know, it's about having the government. You're always trying to make the government, you know, follow the same laws, you know, that we do. Or to borrow an old colloquialism, y'all were some of the first ones that stood up and, you know, told the government, you know, stop pissing on my head and tell me it's raining.
Right. Well, and that is a very good point. I mean, there's two pieces to this. Certainly the Tea Party especially is very much into the government accountability side where they want the same rules to apply to government and its employees and its elected officials than apply to everybody else. And I think that that's a very good starting point, that certainly what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and that we should be treating all people equally. We're not supposed to have a caste system. We're not supposed to have different classes. And we're supposed to have equal protection. That means that if it applies to one, it applies to all. And that's one big piece of this, absolutely. But even go ahead.
I just started saying I'm glad you said that, because that right there is like the gist or the heart of what's going on right now with Obamacare. So many people, everybody has to do it except senators, politicians, and their first layer of aides, right? Well, now that
companies, those guys are getting too.
They're trying to give them the privileges. And the funniest one is the IRS would have fallen under Obamacare. And now the agency, which is supposed to be implementing Obamacare, is saying, we don't want Obamacare. And how many, I call it the lamestream media, has been reporting on that. And you have more and more, you've had unions pull away from the AFL-CIO recently. I think there's been three unions that have pulled out from that one, you know, because of things of that nature. I can't remember how many. Well, I think it started with two, and then there was five, and now I think there's maybe 15 or more Democrats that are like, holy crud. You know, I didn't know this was in here, and the people and the jobs in their states and areas, how it's going to affect them. And they're saying, you know, and they're getting on the no Obamacare bandwagon. So, yeah, I love that. What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Well, and that's where it starts. But then we have to ask the question, do we want drones and the NSA wiretapping and following everybody around? And I still don't even want that. I think that protection is the start. Right. I want equal protection
at the start,
but that is not where it ends.
Yeah. As part of like a conversation, I could see, okay, the Canadian border, so huge. If they wanted to fly drones up and down only the Canadian border, or only fly drones up and down, you know, that exact latitude, longitude flight of the border of the United States between, you know, U.S. and Canada or U.S. and Mexico until they build the wall or whatever in Mexico down there. Yes, I could see for manpower, cost, labor, jobs, et cetera, I could see them doing drone flights on that. But for them doing things like there's a story, I don't know if you caught it or not, but there's a city in Colorado that is selling drone hunting permits.
Yeah.
Because they're going,
we're
it's
almost
my land,
fine,
I own the airspace above it, and if you fly one over my land, I'll shoot it.
Yeah, and we're almost out of time. Mayo, thank you for calling in. I'm putting you back in the queue. Thank you. I did see the drone permits. We covered that on the show. It's hilarious, the drone hunting permits. Folks, here's the point. We've got work to do, and we've got the political momentum behind us. We've talked about that before. Political momentum is on our side. Now we have to use it. We need to be the people leading the charge, leading the call for a pragmatic, realistic solutions right now, and what we want to have 10 years from now, 5 years from now. We can be the ones that say, we have answers. Listen to us. They're good. They're based in liberty. It protects you. It protects me. Folks, thanks for tuning in. Tune in next week for another edition of Liberty Unbridled. Listen to everybody else on the network. I've only got a few seconds left. Thanks for tuning in. Take care. Have a good night.